welcome to All Crime, No Cattle. This is a Texas true crime podcast. I'm Shay.
I'm Aaron.
And how are you guys doing? The true crime posse, our listeners out there. This is episode 7. And what's the title of this episode, Aaron?
This is The Mysterious Death at the Elegante Hotel.
Ooh, the Elegante. That's the elegant hotel, I believe.
Mm-hmm. That's very good. Oh my God, all your French in college really paid off.
Elegante. All right. So, is there anything we need to discuss at the beginning of this episode?
No. So far we've covered a lot of cases, and I think we've done a pretty good job at covering cases that aren't really well known. So this is the first case for us that actually did have a lot of coverage back a few years ago. So this is the story about the mysterious death of Greg Flinnikin at the Elegante Hotel in Beaumont, Texas. So even though there is a lot of information out there about this case, I wanted to cover it because it's really interesting. It's a very mysterious case with a lot of forensics, which I'm really excited about.
Ooh.
And it's a bit of a reprieve from seriously depressing few weeks that we had there covering Robert Ben Rhodes. And
because that was bad.
It was hard. And there are a lot of badasses in this case.
Ooh, I like badasses.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about it, and I hope everybody enjoys this case. So there was a really big Vanity Fair article about this case. It was called The Body in Room 348, written by Mark Bowden. And this is basically the best source of information about this case.
It sounds like a horror novel.
The Body in Room 348. There was also a pretty good 2020 episode about it. I would suggest that you watch that mainly for the really great puns in that episode that are done only like 2020 can.
Oh no, please tell me you saved some of the puns.
I didn't. Oh. You're just gonna have to watch and find out.
Are we gonna tweet the puns out maybe?
Maybe. Okay, so first let's talk about Beaumont, Texas. So we're in a new location this week. Everybody should be very excited. Beaumont is in southeastern Texas. It's about 90 miles east of Houston, so it's really close to the Louisiana border. Like a lot of Texas towns, it really grew in size once one of the largest oil fields in the U.S. was discovered there. It has a population right around 120,000 people, which... that stat surprised me when I first saw it because I've been to Beaumont, or at least I think I have family there, and I would have guessed like 75 people live there. In my mind, Beaumont is just like a cow in a field.
So is it like,
120,000 people? That's a pretty good sized town, really.
Yeah. Is it, so you said it's close to Houston. So is it like really close to the Gulf, like to the coast, or? Like, what
yes,
are we talking?
It oh, is. Okay. It's, and it was actually like a pretty important port city. And oh, I think it still okay. is today. So Greg Flinnikin was a 55-year-old oil businessman from Lafayette, Louisiana. He and his brother owned an oil land leasing business based out of Beaumont. And every week he would drive to Beaumont for work, which was about a 2-hour drive between Lafayette and Beaumont. He would stay at the MCM Elegante Hotel. And basically, he would live out of a suitcase, and then every weekend, he would return home to his wife, Susie, and all of his friends back home in Louisiana. His wife, Susie, is badass number one in this story. So, Greg and Susie had met in their 20s when she was a singer in a rock band.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is awesome. I want to know.
What was the rock band's name?
I don't know. I wish I knew.
But they're like Louisiana-based, so it's got to be.
Louisiana rock band in, I'm guessing, the 70s?
The Disco Shrimps.
God, oh God, I bet it was amazing. They married young in their early 20s. They ended up separating, and then they rekindled their romance and remarried years later. The second time around really stuck, as they had then been married for 15 years. So I can give you all the typical platitudes that we always hear about victims in the media, the things that us in the true crime community always kind of laugh at, because the media, like 2020 Dateline, they always do this like cut and paste thing of describing victims as kind, caring, family man, et cetera, et cetera. And Greg Flinnikin really fit this as well as anyone else. He had a really happy marriage. He had lots of friends. He had a successful career. But what I'll also add to this is that he honestly seemed to be like a pretty cool, down-to-earth guy who was totally unpretentious. So for example, he was a businessman in the oil industry. I can bet he was making pretty good money, but he was totally fine staying at this 3-star Hotel Elegante in Beaumont, Texas each week. This place is not the nicest place in the world. I actually looked it up. It's still around.
Ooh.
It still exists to this day. If we ever go out to Beaumont, we could stay there. It has a decent rating, so that's good. And it charges about $150 a night. A little steep for what I can tell in the pictures, but
it is Hotel Elegante. You're paying for the elegance.
It's a kind of place that it looks like it'll serve you well if you just needed something for the weekend and you didn't want to spend a whole lot of money. And it was fine with Greg during his long work weeks in Beaumont. Greg also was, and I'm sure we all know people like this, and I think they're kind of awesome. He was a guy who kind of just lived his life. You know those people who are basically like, I could die tomorrow, so I'm not going to waste my time going to yoga and eating kale for lunch. He was a heavy smoker. He liked his meals of steak and potatoes. He loved snacking on candy and sweets. And although he didn't really drink in his later life, he had been a fairly heavy drinker earlier on. He looked fairly fit if you saw him, but he didn't exercise. He didn't worry about any of that. He also didn't go to the doctor for checkups or anything. So, you know, he's living the dream. He's one of those guys who just says, life is short. I'm going to live mine. I'm not going to worry about the rest of it.
I feel like I'm trying to live his life.
I feel like I'm 32 and I'm totally living his life. I'm a 55-year-old Greg Flanagan.
So you're basically telling us he's a pizza and beer kind of guy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He would totally hang with us.
Oh, I bet.
So on Wednesday, September 15th, 2010, Greg was in room 348 of the Hotel Elegante, and he was doing pretty much what he did every evening at the hotel. He would lay in bed with a hotel towel laid up out beside him on the bed. On the towel, he would put his pack of cigarettes, an ashtray, a lighter, the TV remote, and a cell phone, so he could talk to his wife or in case he had any sort of late night business emails he had to attend to. He'd also have some snacks. And on this particular evening, he had chosen a Reese's Crispy Crunchy Bar and what looks like in the crime scene photos, a Payday Bar. Hmm. So not the candy bars I would choose, but hey, he's living his life. If he wants a little peanut butter, he wants a little peanut rolled in nougat or whatever the hell a Payday bar is.
Isn't it nougat rolled in peanuts? I think that's what it is. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. What's the Reese's Crispy Crunchy Bar?
I'm not sure. Maybe I don't think it's still around. Yeah. He also had a root beer within arm's reach over here on the nightstand next to him. So he was settled in for the night. He had ordered Iron Man 2 on pay-per-view, and that's what he was going to watch that evening. And this was a pretty typical night for him. He had his snacks. He had his root beer. He was going to watch some TV before he went to bed.
This sounds like me on a training.
He's living the dream. Yeah, this sounds really fantastic.
If I was out of town, I would be having this kind of a night.
This is what I want to do every night, no matter where I am. But the next morning rolls around, and Greg doesn't come into work, which was very highly unusual. He wasn't in the office to take his morning phone call from his wife, Susie. So every morning they would talk. She would call up to the office and they'd chit chat about, you know, their day. And he also wasn't answering his phone. Two of his coworkers were concerned, so they ended up coming to the hotel to check on him. And they grew even more alarmed when he didn't answer the door. So they got the manager to open the door, where they found Greg dead just inside the door to the room. Greg was sprawled face down on the floor with a cigarette still clutched in the fingers of his left hand. The cigarette had been lit at one point, but it had burned out.
Yeah, it had just burned down.
Yeah. So the cops are called to the scene as pretty much a formality. After all, there's no sign of foul play in the room, no signs of a struggle, and the body doesn't show any obvious signs of violence or injury. Okay, so you know how Last Podcast on the Left has their own detective popcorn?
Oh, yeah.
Well, this case has its own delicious sounding detective, Detective Apple.
Detective Apple?
Detective Scott Apple.
Oh, man.
Is on the case.
If his middle name's Caramel.
Well, you know, I think if your name is as innocuous as Scott Apple, I think that means you have to be a really good detective.
Oh, yeah. He's constantly making up for the last name Apple.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He takes down a bad guy and he's like, nobody bites the apple. The apple bites back.
You just got sliced.
Ooh, I like that one.
That really cuts me to the core.
Oh, that's a good one. Okay, so Detective Apple, he doesn't initially see anything here that worries him. Greg's wallet is found in the room with $1,000 cash in it. So it wasn't a robbery. There's no blood. There's nothing out of place. And no one in the neighboring rooms has reported that they've heard anything amiss. So the whole thing just looks like a natural death. And in fact, his family and friends, when they hear about Greg's death, it wasn't hard for them to accept that it was just a natural death. After all, Greg was 55 years old. I mean, he wasn't old by a long shot, but again, he was a heavy smoker. He didn't really take care of himself. He didn't go to the doctor. And so it didn't seem that abnormal that Greg just may have died from a sudden heart attack. Greg's body was transported to Dr. Tommy Brown, the medical examiner for Jefferson County, for an autopsy. Dr. Brown was a highly respected medical examiner who had worked for years in the field. However, we do also have to note that in Jefferson County, there wasn't a lot of murder. And in fact, I think it was about 10 murders a year. So the first thing that Dr. Brown does is an outward inspection of the body, just to try to identify wounds or bruises or anything that's obvious within the outside of the body. He noted a small abrasion on Greg's cheek, and this made sense because this is where his face hit the carpet when he fell. More concerning, however, was swelling and bruising to his groin area and his right hip, and a small laceration to his scrotum. It looked as if something or someone had hit him hard in the groin. Other than the injuries to his groin and the mark on his face, there isn't any other sign of injury to the outside of the body.
I don't like that laceration to the groin.
Yeah, you shouldn't. It's not good stuff.
Yeah, I don't like it at all.
So Dr. Brown then moves on to the internal autopsy, and that's when things start to get real weird. There's extensive internal damage to the inside of the torso and a lot of blood. There were also small lacerations to the intestines, stomach, liver. He had two broken ribs and a hole to the right atrium of the heart. The blood loss was so extreme that he would have basically bled out in under a minute. Dr. Brown explained to Detective Apple that he usually sees this kind of internal damage in victims of car accidents or people who had been crushed under some kind of heavy object. The heavy internal damage was indicative of severe trauma, as if Greg had been beaten to death. This, coupled with the injury to the groin, led Dr. Brown to officially label Greg's cause of death as homicide.
Wow.
Yeah.
So other than the little bit of bruising in the lower abdomen and the pelvic region and the one laceration, he didn't look like he had been in a car accident. Like,
not at all.
He wasn't beaten up and have a bunch of bruises all over.
No, not at
all. Wow.
There was nothing. And like I said, all of the internal injuries were to his torso.
Okay.
So, I mean, the thinking was that somebody had kicked him between the legs, causing these external groin injuries, and then hit him in the chest and stomach, causing the internal damage to the organs.
Huh.
So that's like their first initial impression with this autopsy. And so that's really frustrating because the injuries to his body don't make sense in regards to the physical evidence in the hotel room. And honestly, the injuries, as you're already getting at, the injuries themselves don't make sense. So the pertinent question is this: how does somebody's inner organs get ruptured? How do your ribs break? How does your heart get perforated with no bruising and no external damage to the body?
Aliens. He was abducted.
I'm trying to think of a good comeback, but I don't have one.
That's okay. You can just let it ride.
And if Greg had been violently assaulted enough to cause the extensive internal injuries, how did it happen within a hotel room that had no sign of a struggle and without anyone hearing anything?
Yeah, his stuff was still laid out all organized.
Yep. And weirdest of all, if he had been assaulted, why was he still holding a lit cigarette?
Ooh, can I ask a great question?
You absolutely can.
Did it have that thing where, like, whenever you see somebody who's fallen asleep with a cigarette in their hand that they've just lit, it's got that perfect ash thing coming down it?
I don't know. I didn't see photos of the body or anything, so I'm not sure. Okay. I'm assuming that's what it was, though. Like, the whole cigarette had burned down to the butt or whatever.
Because if he hadn't have moved, then it would have just, like, had that perfect little fragile tower of ash sitting there on the butt.
Why does that excite you so much?
Oh, it does. Well, I was wondering if that was, like, a linchpin of the case. That's all. Like, oh, well, they could tell because the ashes had been scattered.
Oh, you're asking the good questions. Yeah. All right. So far, what are you thinking? Do you have any hypotheses about what could have happened here?
I mean, it's really interesting how you could sustain that kind of internal damage without anything exterior and without a struggle in a room. It has to be set up, the crime scene. Like, it has to some, but he had everything laid out like he usually does. Oh, this is really interesting. I don't know.
All right. Well, now you're feeling how investigators felt, because they also were kind of like, what the hell happened?
I'm sticking with aliens for now.
So they pull Greg's phone and email records, and they don't see anything there that would explain why someone would want him dead. So he's a businessman, he's often away from home, and he's found dead in a hotel room. Obviously, first suspicion might be he has a mistress who is angry and got pissed off and killed him. But there's nothing in Greg's personal communication that showed he was anything but a devoted husband to Susie. There was also nothing to show that he was involved in any shady business dealings or that there was anyone threatening him. And in fact, he was pretty much universally liked by family, friends, and coworkers. There was also nothing in the hotel room that could have fallen on him to cause any of these injuries that they saw, and he had not been injured at work previously. But Apple did, in this sort of initial part of the investigation, he did uncover a few interesting things about the night that Greg died. So earlier that evening, Greg had been making some popcorn in the microwave for his movie. So remember, he's watching Iron Man 2. He's got two candy bars and a root beer. That's not going to cut it, man. You need some popcorn to top it off. Top off your night with Iron Man.
Are you telling me Detective Apple has stumbled upon some seeds?
Those are kernels. I'm not sure that joke works. Oh. So he's making popcorn in the microwave, and he trips the circuit breaker in his room. So this outage affected several rooms in the hotel. So Greg called the front desk to tell him what happened, which I'm sure he was more than a little embarrassed about. One time I was staying in London and I was by myself and I was trying to make a pot of coffee. So I turned the coffee maker on and I went to the bathroom to go do something. And I didn't realize the entire room was filling with smoke from the coffee maker. And I ended up somehow setting off the fire alarm in the entire hotel.
Oh my God.
And so they called me and they were like, "Are you smoking in your room?" I was like, "God, no, I was just trying to make a pot of coffee." So I feel him. I feel you, Greg. I get it. So he calls up to the front desk and they get a maintenance man to come to his room to reset the circuit breaker. It just so happens that this maintenance man was a registered sex offender. So Hotel Elegante, what are you doing?
It's not very elegant.
Let's do some background checks
on
your people whose job it is to go into people's hotel rooms. You got a registered sex offender on the list.
That's not what you want at Hotel Elegante.
Somehow I don't think that they're going to use that as their motto anytime soon. This was important for a couple different reasons. So first of all, Greg liked his room to be really, really cold. But in the morning when his body was found, the room was hot and the air conditioning unit was not on. So this indicated that Greg's death had happened shortly after the maintenance man had left the room and before Greg had gotten a chance to realize that the air conditioner had been turned off. This would be sometime between 8:30 and 9 p.m. that evening. So Apple wondered if Greg's murder could have been some kind of sexual assault by the maintenance man with the laceration to his scrotum caused by a screwdriver or some other kind of tool. You know, he's going with this and he's questioning the maintenance guy and looking into his background. And eventually he realizes there's really nowhere to go with this theory. And this guy wasn't the murderer.
What makes him realize that?
It didn't really state why. I mean, I'm assuming it might have something to do with the kind of charge he had gotten on his record before. Maybe it had nothing to do with assaulting a grown man. Either way, he shouldn't be a maintenance man in a hotel.
Maybe he had an alibi or something.
Like that. So it was something that made him like completely dismiss that as an idea. The other working hypothesis was, what if someone got pissed off that Greg had inadvertently killed electricity in their room? They went to Greg's room to have words with him, assaulted him in the hallway, and then dumped his body back into his own hotel room. He's thinking about this, and he knows that there was a group of electricians who had been hanging out in room 349. So this is the room right next door. And they were in town from Wisconsin to work on one of the oil rigs in the area, which I don't know why you're going to call in specialty electricians from Wisconsin and Beaumont, but...
Well, maybe the equipment is specialized where they have to call in some special electricians.
Maybe that's what it is. So these guys were known to hang out together in this room and they would stay up late at night and drink all together. So Apple wondered if maybe one of them had gotten pissed off about the electricity thing and come over and assaulted Greg.
Room rage as opposed to road rage.
But the morning of Greg's death, they had been questioned and they had said that they hadn't spoken to the man next door. So they had been curious because they were out in the hallway when Greg's body had been wheeled out in the body bag. And so they had seen him getting taken away. And so they had been curious, like, oh, my gosh, what happened? This is so horrible. They told Apple that they had been drinking in the room, but they had later moved into the hotel bar and then went back up to the room later that night. None of them claimed to know anything or saw anything or heard anything suspicious the night before. So later after the autopsy, Apple went back to the hotel to kind of re-interview potential witnesses. At this point, they know that it's a homicide. So he spoke to the electricians again. They were really agreeable about talking to Apple and reiterated the same thing. They hadn't seen her any or heard of anything, but they gave him their contact information in case he needed, you know, that he needed to speak with them again. And that was that. So another hypothesis that he was working off of was ideas that maybe Greg's wife or his brother slash business partner had had him killed. But he considered this. He abandoned it after meeting with Greg's wife and meeting with the brother and realizing there was absolutely no evidence to point to any either one of those. So Detective Apple worked this case for about 6 months, and he came up with nothing to explain Greg's death. And eventually the case goes cold, and Susie Flinnigan is pissed about it. She wants answers about what happened to her husband. So Susie gets an idea to hire her own private investigator. And a friend of hers tells her about a former New York cop and DEA agent turned private eye, Ken Brannon.
What?
So Ken Brannon joins the case. And get this, this is how these connections were made. The way Susie finds out about Brannon is her friend had read an article about him in Vanity Fair by the same author of the article that I'm referencing here, by Mark Bowden. And this article was called The Case of the Vanishing Blonde, where the author had detailed this case where Brennan had helped solve a cold case in Miami back in the early 2000s.
Holy crap.
So that's how she found out about this guy. They were like, this is a amazing PI who's really good at cold cases. Let's get him to join the team. And let's see what he can do. So, and he seems like a total badass. So this is badass number two.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
I mean, maybe three if you want to consider Greg himself a badass, which
I will. Let's consider Greg a badass.
So this is badass number three. And so he joins the team. If you watch the 2020 episode, you can see this really, like, really sweet footage of him like driving around on a motorcycle and like smoking cigars and like playing golf.
No, he rode a motorcycle and smoked cigars.
Yes.
Oh my God.
This guy is amazing.
He's my hero.
Right now, I want you to promise me if I ever get murdered and they can't figure it out who, you need to get Brennan on the case.
I will.
And maybe Apple.
I'm imagining that Brennan looks like the dude from Renegade, the TV show.
I don't.
Oh, no. There's some real TNT late night people that are getting that joke.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, good for them. So Ken Brennan meets with Scott Apple, and Brennan basically tells him he wants to work this case as a team. He relayed that he still respected Apple and that he knew that it was his case. So he comes at him from a place of, you know, respect. Or, I'm not trying to take this away from you. Apple, for his part, was really happy to have a fresh pair of eyes on the case. So they immediately got along and they started diligently digging back through the case files and backtracking through what was already known about what happened to Greg. So they start going through the autopsy report and the crime scene photos, and Brennan realized that the cigarette in Greg's hand was kind of odd. Oh, you look so excited.
Yeah.
It's not about the ash
That's
pile.
Fine. That's fine. I'm just intrigued about that cigarette.
Well, first it showed that he either delicately held it in his hand while being violently assaulted, which makes no sense, or that he got violently assaulted, went into his hotel room, lit up a cigarette, and then immediately collapsed and died. Also doesn't make any sense.
Seems set up.
He also noted that Greg was right-handed, but the cigarette was found in his left hand.
Ooh.
So he calls up Susie, and he confirmed that Greg always smoked with his dominant right hand. Knowing that it was crazy to think his attackers had put a lit cigarette in his hand after killing him, which is what you were just suggesting. I'm sorry, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
He realized the most logical conclusion was that Greg had lit up a cigarette just before his death, that he hadn't been beaten up, but something else had happened, and that something that had happened had made him switch his cigarette from his right hand to his left hand just before his death.
Ooh, like he was throwing a punch.
Maybe. We'll see what happens.
I'm just the audience here, just guessing as we go along.
I know, and it's so weird because...
As you were reading it, were you doing this? Were you like,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and it's weird because you're just like, what the hell is going on? And once I tell you what happened, because we do have an answer, so that's something.
Excellent.
Once I tell you what happened, you're like, oh, that's really obvious. But it seems so mysterious that you're like, aliens is the only possible answer. Apple and Brennan also reviewed the hotel security footage, which showed Greg entering the hotel after work that evening. And they also noticed the electricians next door making a few trips out to their vehicles outside. But other than that, there wasn't anything that seemed to be related to Greg's death. Okay. Now, I'm about to get to the meat and potatoes, just like Greg liked to have every night.
Just like he'd
the
have
the meat and potatoes of the case about how they solved it. And you look like you have something to say. So do you have questions before I get to the answers?
Yes, I do. I have a list of questions that need answers, and I suspect that the listeners do too.
Okay.
First of all, I am suspecting, here's one of my theories.
Okay.
That his cigarette was found in his left hand. He's right hand dominant. So I'm thinking, if you're a right-handed smoker and someone knocks on your door, you're going to go up to the door and reach out with your right hand, switch hands with the cigarette temporarily to see who's at the door.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and then like something happens there at that point.
Oh, okay.
So either that, which then again, how could you survive a struggle with that cigarette still in your hand? So again, I'm still thinking it might be planted.
Uh-huh,
but
okay.
Also, that makes me wonder whose prints are on the doorknob, and did they scrub the room down for prints? I'm imagining.
Well, okay, so nowhere I saw it really got into the fine details about the forensics that they collected in the room. I'm assuming that they did go and try to pull as many prints and everything as they could. But especially, you know, once the autopsy report concluded that he had been actually murdered. But, you know, this is a 3-star hotel.
Oh, no.
I've been to 3-star hotel. I mean, that's what I frequent, honestly.
Oh,
that's,
you don't that's, frequent, though.
That's fine. And that's like fine living for me. So, I mean, I don't know how well does a
so what you're telling me is
cleaning crew clean a 3-star hotel.
So you're telling me Hotel Elegante maybe doesn't clean the rooms as much as they should?
Probably
it's slightly a contaminated
crime
scene.
There is probably DNA
fingerprints
littering that place.
This goes into a whole larger discussion about crimes committed in 3-star hotels.
Oh, God. Oh.
But yeah, they're still charging $150 a night, though.
That's what I'm saying. A little steep there, Hotel Elegante. Especially when you don't do background checks on your workers.
Also, you know, if they didn't find prints of anybody, that makes you suspect that maybe the cleaning crew might be involved.
Oh.
Mr. Appleseed or whatever that detective's name was.
It's just John. Apple.
He's a long descendant of Johnny Appleseed.
Okay. Well, you know, that's also a working theory that can be Detective Shay's theory.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he has been staying at this hotel for fairly long. I don't know how long he had been staying at this hotel, but at least months, I would assume. So he might have a bit of a relationship with the cleaning crew.
Ooh.
I mean, I didn't mean anything weird by that. Oh. Your ooh made it weird, though.
Well, I got the ooh out.
All right, so let's get back to the case. So the next thing that they do is they go back to the hotel to do another thorough search to see if anything had been missed. They search the entire place, floor to ceiling, and they don't find anything else in the room that would explain Greg's death. And just about when they're going to give up, Brennan sees a part of the wall that had been repaired. At first, he thinks that it's just an indentation from the doorknob, but when he opens the door and lines up the doorknob with this indentation, he sees that it doesn't match up. So he's like, that's a little weird. So they go next door to room 349, the room where the electricians had been staying, and they find what is clearly an entrance hole made by a bullet on the other side of the wall. The hole had been patched up with toothpaste and toilet paper, but it was still plainly obvious.
Whoa.
So when they lined up the trajectory of the holes between the rooms, they saw that the holes lined up perfectly to where Greg would have been sitting on the bed the night of his death.
What?
So now they're pretty sure that Greg had been shot. But in order to move forward in the case, they have to get the medical examiner, Dr. Brown, to agree to officially change the cause of death, which they knew wouldn't be easy because by doing so, Dr. Brown would have to admit that he had been wrong and that he had misidentified a bullet wound. So they go to Dr. Brown and they very diplomatically try to argue their case. But Dr. Brown immediately shuts them down. He tells them it's impossible that Greg had been shot. They gently ask him to go over the autopsy photos with them. At this point, Greg's body had been cremated, so there wasn't a way to have the body exhumed to do another examination. So all they have are these autopsy photos. They argue for a few minutes over the damage to the internal organs, with Brennan and Apple saying that the damage could have been done by a bullet, and Dr. Brown saying that the same damage could have been caused by a beating. So they keep kind of arguing back and forth until they get to the photos of the heart. Brennan takes one look at the photo, points to the laceration in the atrium of the heart, and says bluntly, "That's a fucking bullet hole."
Wow, he says it that way, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
At first, Dr. Brown is like, "No way, that's not possible." But then he takes another look at the photo, and he just quietly goes, "The media is going to kill me on this."
Oh, no.
Yeah. So finally, the whole picture of what happened that night is pieced together. Someone from room 349 had shot a bullet through the adjoining wall to room 348. The bullet had whizzed through the air and entered Greg's body as he was laying in bed, smoking a cigarette and watching his movie. The bullet had pierced his scrotum and torn its way up through his intestines, liver, stomach, and into his heart, also breaking two of his ribs in the process. He jumped up from the bed, probably in a great amount of pain and in complete shock and having no idea what had just happened to him, and tried to make his way to the door of the room in a blind panic. And as he reached the door, he transferred his cigarette, as you said, from his right hand to his left hand as he went to reach for the door handle to try to get help.
I knew it.
But before he got there, he collapsed on the floor, where he would have died within seconds.
Oh, Greg.
Yeah,
I know. But wouldn't there be blood everywhere if you'd have been shot like that?
There really wasn't, though.
Huh.
Yeah.
It must have been a really...
There was... The autopsy report said that there was edema, which is just like body fluid, but not... There wasn't blood.
Man.
So I guess it's just the weird way it entered his body.
Or maybe it was a really small caliber of bullet.
Well, I'll tell you the caliber in a second, and you can tell me if that's true, because I don't know anything about guns. So they now know what happened. They just need to get the guys who did it. And they know it all started with the electricians partying in the room next to Greg's. The three electricians who had been staying in the room were Tim Steinmetz, Lance Mueller, and Trent Pisano. It was 7 or 8 months after Greg's death when Apple and Brennan go to Wisconsin to begin interviewing them at the Chippewa County Sheriff's Department. The first one they talk to is Tim Steinmetz. They go to him. They're real relaxed. They're reassuring him that the interview is just routine, no biggie. They're completely comfortable and really nice to him. Steinmetz recounts the same story that they had been telling all along. They had been drinking in their hotel room in room 349 earlier that night that Greg died. They later moved to the hotel bar, and then they had returned to their rooms later that night. End of story. They didn't hear anything from the room next door. They didn't see anything weird. That's pretty much it. So Brennan and Apple have him make a statement, go over it multiple times to make sure that it was correct, keep asking him if that's the full story, etc., and then, with an extra special touch of pettiness, which I absolutely love, they bring in a local cop to come in and notarize the statement right there in front of him. So Steinmetz at this point is, you know, he's feeling a little relaxed and he's feeling good about what's happening. He's like, oh, cool, I'm about to leave. He's getting ready to get up to go, and Apple and Brennan immediately go, with a completely different tone of voice, "Not so fast. You just made a false police report. We know exactly what happened in that hotel room that night."
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So they're calling his bluff.
Oh, yeah. So Apple and Brennan tell Steinmetz that they know what happened. They know he's trying to protect one of his buddies and tell him it's not worth it. He needs to spill what actually happened that night. And it works because Steinmetz then tells the entire story.
Oh, good for them.
And the story is later corroborated by Trent Pisano, which is one of the other electricians who was in that room that night. So these three had been drinking beer and hanging out in room 349. Lance Mueller had asked Trent Pisano to go grab a bottle of whiskey and his 9mm Ruger from his car. I don't know.
Oh, you're asking about the caliber?
Yeah, 9mm Ruger.
It's a
handgun.
Yeah, it's a pretty typical handgun.
Yeah.
German-made, smaller caliber. It's not as small as a 22, but it's still a smaller, fast round.
Okay.
Yeah. So that makes sense. It would have been really fast traveling.
And could have gone through
probably
a wall and like through the air and
Yeah, like 9mm can go through bulletproof vests, I believe.
Okay. So Pisano did this, and when Mueller got the gun, he started waving it around like a real drunk idiot. He's pointing at both Pisano and Steinmetz. He's laughing as they're ducking around. They're telling him to quit it. You know, they're getting really frustrated with him. And he's pointing it at Pisano when the gun goes off. Pisano initially like freaks out. He ducks to the ground and he's thinking that he had been hit. And so he's like tapping him. Oh my God, I've been hit. He realized he wasn't. They all turn around and look at the wall and they see the bullet hole. So Mueller runs out of the room. He takes the gun back to his car. So that's why in the security footage that Apple and Brennan were looking at, they see the electricians making like a couple different trips to the vehicle.
One to get the gun and then...
And one to go run the gun back to the car.
Wow.
So Pisano gets pissed off about everything that's just happened and he goes back to his own room. So he's completely done with the situation. Mueller and Steinmetz, at some point, either this evening or later on, patch the hole in the wall with toothpaste and toilet paper.
Man, that's such a like a frat house thing to do.
Yeah. This whole thing is a frat house thing to do.
Wow.
And then they just go downstairs to the hotel bar and keep drinking.
I wonder if there were witnesses to see like what their mood was when they were in the bar. Not that I know of.
So... Steinmetz admitted that they never checked to make sure that the guy next door was okay. Never knocked on the door, never told anybody, nothing. Later, super paranoid, Mueller had taken the gun to his lawyer for safekeeping and had his lawyer check up on the case to see what the autopsy results were. Because he had, of course, an inkling that maybe he had caused the person's death next door.
Yeah.
Well, when it was announced that Greg had died from being beaten or crushed with the initial autopsy results, he was able to basically delude himself into thinking that his gunshot had nothing to do with Greg's death.
Yeah.
So after Steinmetz confesses all of this, Brennan and Apple have him call Lance Mueller to tell him that he just admitted the whole story to the cops and that Mueller should turn himself in. And after a while, Mueller basically does. So this is the thing. If at any time during the 8 months of investigation, Mueller had come forward about this errant gunshot, he probably never would have been charged with anything. And he probably never would have served a day in jail because this is Texas. And whether you hate gun culture or love gun culture, what it does is makes accidental shootings less of a big deal than what you'd maybe see in other places. So it's the kind of thing that comes with the territory when you live in a state like Texas that really loves its guns. Even according to the article, accidental gun deaths, it's kind of a gray area in Texas code.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And so even when the full story came out and they knew what had happened, the county district attorney's office still didn't really want to prosecute the case and they were considering giving Mueller a plea deal.
Wow.
Yeah. So when Brennan and Susie heard this, do you know what these two badasses did?
I bet they got real pissed.
Oh, they got pissed. They flew back into Beaumont and went in person, and Brennan delivered an impassioned speech, which I'm going to quote in its entirety because it's real badass, just like he is. Little fair warning, there's a lot of F-bombs because we're talking about Ken Brennan, and he's a badass.
Hey, you know that? That's what comes with being a private investigator. You can start dropping F-bombs.
Oh, yeah, nobody gives a F. So what he says was... This was not a fucking accident. An accident is when somebody comes in, has taken off their gun discharges, and God forbid, somebody is hit. It's completely different when somebody brings a fucking gun that they shouldn't have had into another fucking state, shit-faced drunk, fucking around with a gun. He discharges around, almost kills the guy he's with, and then he does kill somebody on the other side of the wall. He doesn't even bother to knock on the door to see if somebody's hurt. And after that, his answer is to go get drunk some more in the fucking bar of the hotel? And then when he sees a body being taken out the next day and he's 100% certain he killed somebody, he decides to not say anything about it, but runs to his attorney and leaves the fucking weapon in a safe. You know what that is? That's fucking murder.
Yeah, it's at least manslaughter for sure.
Well, that's exactly right, because on October 29th, 2012, Lance Mueller pled no contest to manslaughter and received 10 years in prison.
Well, that's good.
10 years in prison. He's probably going to get 5. So he's probably, I looked up sort of like.
Well, he'd be out by now, right?
Yeah, I looked up the details in the case and I couldn't find any information about him being out, but he's probably up for parole pretty soon. If not, he's already been paroled. But the judge pointed to many facts in the case that led to the sentence. So again, he had taken the gun across straight lines He decided to drunkenly play with the gun in the hotel room, and then he had covered his tracks by patching the hole in the wall, hiding the gun, and then even giving the gun to his attorney. He clearly realized there was a definite chance that the stray bullet had been what killed Greg, and yet he had specifically tried to hide it from everyone to hope that he wouldn't be found out.
Yeah, those are all very valid points.
Exactly. So Susie had a chance to speak to her husband's murderer after sentencing, and she said, "You murdered him. No, you didn't intentionally seek him out to murder him, but you murdered him with every lie you told, with every intentional selfish deception, with every cover-up, over and over again. You saw his body taken out of the room in a body bag the next day. You knew you killed him. He meant nothing to you."
Yeah, that's a valid point.
Susie's also a badass.
Yeah.
So neither Steinmetz or Pisano were charged in the case, which I think is a little odd. I mean, especially Steinmetz. I mean, they tricked him into making a false police report. And Pisano was lying to the police just as much as Steinmetz was. So that's a little obstruction of justice, you would think, at least.
Yeah, it's definitely not cool of them to do that.
Yeah.
It also makes me wonder how crazy Mueller was, since he is playing with a gun when he gets drunk. Like, had he threatened them not to say anything?
I don't think that was the case. Okay. I think it was really a case where they were all buddies and they were trying to cover his ass. I didn't hear anything about them being scared of him or anything like that.
Shoot, if I had a buddy that liked to get drunk and play with his gun and
accidentally
shot the
wall.
No,
you would not be your buddy anymore.
No, I would be like, all right, that's it. Mm-hmm. You're getting turned in.
So after Mueller got his sentence, Ken Brennan went back to being a total badass. He's probably off riding his motorcycles and solving cases left and right somewhere, probably. In 2012, Susie went on to file a wrongful death civil lawsuit against Steinmetz, Pisano, and Mueller for her husband's death. And she also filed a suit against the MCM Elegante Hotel, saying that the hotel didn't appropriately provide adequate security or perform a proper investigation after the shooting or after, you know, the death. Also hadn't done anything. This was a group of guys who were being rowdy and drinking and hadn't done anything to stop that. However, the latest information on that I could find is that Susie later filed a motion to dismiss the case, saying that she resolved her claims against one of the defendants, Trent Pisano, and then the trial was canceled. So I don't really know what that means. Like it was settled out of court or something. I don't know why she resolved it with Trent Pisano, but no one else. I'm not really sure what happened. And usually if is a thing where it was settled out of court, then it would say it was settled out of court.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure what happened, but the case was, you know, it didn't go forward. So that's pretty much it. But I think Susie is super happy that she at least got justice for her husband. And like I said, should anything ever happen to me, you better have Ken Brennan on the line.
Well, the next thing that this makes me think about is, you know, we've often talked about either being buried or cremated, and you and I typically settle on being cremated. But then we always think about these cases where what if something weird happens and we get cremated?
If it's obvious what happened to me, cremate me. If there's any kind of mystery, if maybe someone murdered me, you better have me in the ground full so they can do an autopsy.
Like if you have
I want my murderer brought to justice for sure.
So if you have some weird lesion on your groin and it looks like you've been in a car wreck on the inside, but on the outside you look fine, just be like, hold the bus. Let's not cremate her yet.
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. I would like the same from you as well.
Okay.
Is there anything else we need to discuss in this case?
No, like I said, I mean, for all the information about the case itself and how it was solved, there's not a lot of information about the aftermath. So I'm just like, what's going on with these cases, or, you know, what happened to Susie? I don't know those details, but
even if you're shot with a 9mm in the groin, I can't believe that there wasn't that much blood.
I know that. And that's the reason why it's such a weird case. And one of the things that they did say is, okay, so there was obviously an entry wound to the body that was in the scrotum. And what they said was, I guess the way that the scrotum, the skin folds, that the skin would have like folded over the laceration in such a way that it wouldn't have been an obvious bullet wound. And I guess maybe since it pierced the scrotum, that's why there was just edema and fluid and not blood. And he had only been, remember, he had been laying down and then he had just gotten up for a second and then collapsed. So I guess maybe, and then it almost immediately died.
And if your heart stops immediately,
yeah,
then your blood's
so
not
I guess
pumping
that makes
anymore.
Sense why there wasn't a lot of blood like coming out of that wound. But I mean, it's such a bizarre
bizarre
way to die. And I mean, thankfully, I guess what we can say is it does look, I mean, there's a little bit of questions about how long did he survive. And if you read the article, it'll go into some of those details, like maybe he might have survived a little bit longer, but they pretty much think that he didn't live that long. And, you know, so it's not like he suffered. So, I mean, that's something, I guess.
What are you going to throw up?
But I mean, just such a, what are the odds?
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah.
That something like that could have happened. And maybe that's why you shouldn't play with guns.
Well, you know, we live in Texas and every year on New Year's or 4th of July, people shoot their guns up in the air.
People are constantly getting accidentally shot.
Yeah. People will shoot.
And then people wonder why I don't like guns. Okay.
Well, people will shoot their guns up in the air for 4th of July or New Year's. And every year it's always like, oh, some lady got hit with a bullet in the shower.
Yep. Yeah, it happens all the time. Yeah. And that's why that they were saying it's apparently a gray area, because it happens so often and people are so loosey-goosey on it. Like, juries don't really want to convict if they see it as an accident. So, I mean, it's just a hard thing to prosecute, which is
that's
a little unsettling, I think.
That's so crazy considering the other details, like the judge and that the detective later pointed out how it was clearly manslaughter, at least, if not murder.
Yeah.
All right, well, do we have anything other things? Oh, what are you going to throw up on the Instagram from this case for extra bonus content? We usually tweet or Instagram bonus content out there. If you're not on it, get on it.
Well, obviously, I'll put out some pictures of both Greg and Susie. I'll put out a picture of the badass Ken Brennan.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's a cool guy.
Man, I want to see him on his
motorcycle. That I want to hang out with. Oh, my God, I want to hang out with him.
Is there any way if we could get a poster of him on the motorcycle, he'd sign it for us?
That'd be great.
Man, that'd be a great Patreon like thing we could give out.
And then I'll probably give out some pictures of the hotel room.
Okay.
You know, that kind of stuff. There's not a whole lot of specific details that are related to the case. So.
Sure.
Well, that is it for me. So what's our good news for the week? Give me something good.
Okay, so this week our good news is actually about two high school students, and they go to high school in the Woodlands. I'm not exactly sure where that is, but we can look it up. Yeah, so they're high school sophomores. One's 15-year-old Courtney Brumley, and another is 16-year-old Avery Palacios. And they were competing in this Health Occupation Students of America competition, which actually goes down later this month. They'll find out if they won or not. The pair wanted to do something really cool, and they wanted to focus on something that was going to do something good for women specifically. They kind of directed their focus towards domestic violence, and they got this idea that they were going to maybe do like a donation drive for the Montgomery County Women's Center. And this particular center provides a 24-hour hotline, a safe shelter, crisis intervention, counseling, advocacy, and legal services to survivors of family violence, sexual assault, and stalking. It's a really good place that needs help, and they're constantly needing supplies and, you know, other necessities for 75 women and their children each night. So it was a really good place to start, and they wanted to partner with them in this competition, and they ended up, they kind of had their sights set low. They were looking to maybe just collect like decent carload worth of donations and just help these women out. Well, do you know how much they ended up collecting, Aaron?
No.
Well, just guess.
A million.
Oh, well, that's way too high.
Sorry.
A million. Jeez. So how they had originally planned on collecting donations through the end of December. They stopped after only 2 weeks because they had so many items, thanks to the team at Wood Forest, who had collected more than $4,000 worth of donations. It was actually like three huge like truckloads of donations. And it actually filled up like their entire welcome center area with the donations that they provided this facility.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They actually partnered with Faith Pittman, the marketing manager of Wood Forest Johnson Development Company. And she joined their efforts. Of Brumley and Palacios, she said the passion that these two girls had, they were so excited about the organization, and we thought that we just had to see what they could do. And we wanted to partner with them and give them all the support that they needed to affect these victims of domestic abuse. So that's really cool. They also consulted and like got Walmart on board. And so they were able to get like volunteers to go to Walmart and spend $2,500 on toys and other requested items for the clinic.
That's awesome. So this was all for a charity drive that was also a
competition? It was their idea to do a focus on getting donations for this women's shelter, specifically for a project involving the Health Occupation Students of America,
which they were
a part of with their high school.
Uh-huh. Well, that's awesome. That seems like a really great way to encourage kids to give back to the community and everything.
Oh, yeah. And the girls go on to talk about, like, not only did it help them come outside of kind of where their place in the community was, which was coming from a place of wealth and privilege, to go and see some of the people that are inside their community who haven't had those things. They're the have-nots, you know. They're women who have largely been forgotten about in this community, and it brought them and members of their high school closer to this women's shelter. And it helped the students grow and helped the high school grow as an understanding of what their community needs were. And it's kind of touching to hear some of the things that they said about these women. I feel like there's a stigma associated with it where everyone is really wealthy and everyone is really well off. At least that's what it's like where we come from. It was an eye-opening experience for us to see these women and what they have to deal with. And I feel like it's also good for us to know, because we're going into high school and college, and it's good for us to see these things for ourselves and to partner with these women. And it actually, Palacios said that she wants to continue doing things involving human rights and domestic violence when she goes into college, that it's really developed a passion for these types of projects with her. So that's kind of cool. And there's pictures in this article of like a lot of the things that they were able to provide the Women's Center. And of course, it was the holidays at the time when they were doing this in December. So there's a lot of like Christmas gifts, but there's also necessities that these women and children were going to be needing at this time.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think it also really strongly relates to the theme of true crime, because a lot of perpetrators of family violence and domestic violence are also murderers.
Yeah.
And vice versa. A lot of murderers are people who beat their wives and their kids and everything. So I think that's, we know that there's that connection there. So it definitely even makes sense for us to be doing that in this broadcast.
Yeah. And I think it shows as like a significance where you can take something like a women's shelter where horrible things have happened to these broken families, and you can bring your community together with some of these young, intelligent women who can move forward and help in these kind of passions.
Yeah, it's definitely cool to see young kids, you know, wanting to give back to their communities and wanting to learn about their communities and what people, you know, what sort of walk a mile in other people's shoes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Cool.
Well, very good job. That is a good story that I'm happy about.
Yeah,
so now
me too.
I feel all warm and fuzzy inside.
All right. It's time to get down to brass tacks, as they say, and cover our end of the bargain. We need to give some shout outs, Aaron.
Okay. Would you like me to go first?
Yeah, go for it.
Remember, these are our shout outs. So if you give us a 5-star iTunes review, we will read your review on the podcast. So the first one comes from Cold Traces Podcast.
Whoa.
Now, this is one that I have recently binged, and it's a really fantastic podcast that I would highly recommend. I also gave them a 5-star review.
Oh, we love Cold Traces.
Really, yeah, they're a really fantastic podcast. But what they say is, I'm loving this new true crime podcast. Shay and Aaron have great chemistry. It makes for great listening, and I love the stories they choose. The podcast also has great production quality. Keep the episodes coming. So thank you, Cold Traces. That means a lot, because you are also a very great podcast.
We like you, Cold Traces. Keep doing what you're doing. All right. Lime Zapra 626 gives us 5 stars. And the title of this review is very intriguing. Love the podcast. The way you share all your information is easy to understand and follow along. Have to admit that I was hooked after the first episode and binge listened to every episode.
Oh,
all right.
I'd like to hear that.
We love binge listeners. Thank you, Lime Zapra 626.
All right, this one comes from FabCav22. It says, yeehaw! So darn tootin' in love with Shaw and Aaron. Okay, so So this is my favorite one because I believe that their phone
auto-corrected
every time that they wrote Shay. So S-H-E-A. They wrote Shaw, S-H-A-W, which is now the way I'm going to say your name from now on.
I think that's just my outlaw name. Shaw.
Makes my 3 hours of commute each day bearable. I'm an AC-NC junkie. Keep up the great work, guys, but please get a Facebook page. I left a review the other day but can't find it. Maybe if it takes a few days to post, I bug Shay on Facebook to get a shout-out. Now I get my shout-out, Angela Bruscato. So thank you, Angela. And you will be happy to know that we are going to be creating a Facebook page. A page, not a group, but a Facebook page. So you can go there and we'll have a discussion post set up and everything so you can talk about each episode. You can talk about the cases and even talk about cases that you hope that we cover in the future, because we would like to have that more open to you guys, for you guys to suggest cases that are coming from your hometowns or cases that you've heard a lot about but maybe don't know a lot about. Yeah. And so we would love to do that for you guys. So thank you, Angela Bruscato. We will be creating a Facebook page by next week's episode. We'll have more information to share with you guys about that.
Okay, so the next one is titled Fun Texas Size True Crime, and it's by C. Mishishk. C. Missage. I love the host relationship and how they choose different crimes that I haven't heard of before. Love it. Thank you, C. Missage.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you want to talk about?
Well, we do have some things ruminated in the background, but we got to work on them some more.
We're not ready to concrete anything yet. Yep.
So no, is the answer to your question.
Do we have a promo at the end of this episode from one of our friends of the podcast?
Oh, we do. I'm really excited about this one. This is True Crime Story Time. This is an Australian true crime podcast. They're really fantastic.
They're awesome.
They have fantastic Australian accents.
They're super nice.
Yeah. And we really like them. We're Twitter friends with them. And we think it's a really great podcast, and we hope that you like it too. So please stay tuned in just a second. As soon as this episode ends, we're going to be having a word from them.
Yep. And finally, the K-9 crime unit have all bedded down. They've been real jerks this episode. They've been playing. Yeah.
5 minutes before the episode ends is when they decide to go to sleep.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
I don't know if you could hear this earlier on, but one of our dogs was literally climbing on the top of the futon where Aaron is sitting.
I was slapping her as I was reading. All right. All right. Well, that's everything for us. So we will be back at the same time. So again, this episode got put out like a day late. We're still trying to get back on track to where we were releasing, but next week, we're totally imagining that we will be out at the same time, same place, Wednesday for your true crime
midweek hour. Nope.
Midweek.
Messed it up again.
Hump. I don't know what it is.
Oh my God. Midweek hump day hot hour.
There we go. All right. Well, we will see you next week. Be sure to stay tuned for True Crime Story Time's promo.
Yep.
And we'll see you soon.
And
bye, guys.
Always remember, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all.
Mm-hmm.
Adios.
I'm Casey.
And I'm Samantha.
And we're the hosts of True Crime Storytime, a podcast for all things true crime.
We will be bringing you fortnightly episodes covering everything from murder and mysteries, disappearances, theft and fraud,
abductions and kidnappings, and more importantly, trying to take a lesson away from each case, because every story has a message.